I remember many years ago, there was a book published by Visantra, who some of you, I think, will have met, and it was called Meeting the Buddhas. And I remember being quite impressed by the title that he was talking, Meeting the Buddhas. He was talking in the present tense rather than in the past tense. I found that quite fascinating. Of course, Buddhism started with a man, I think it was the name Gautama, about 2,500 years ago. And he's born into quite a prosperous family. I think his dad had been a ruler in this state. And he was expected to follow that path as well, and also to become a ruler. And I think, as probably maybe all of us know, Gautama felt that kind of conventionally successful lifestyle wouldn't help him to address some deeper issues that troubled him. For example, the inevitability of old age, sickness, death, however successful or not we are. And so he went forth, gave it all up, and went out into the jungle and tried to find an answer to those questions. And he tried out the prominent meditation teachers of the day. He tried out their practices, and he seems to have been very successful within their frame of reference, but he felt it didn't quite answer these questions. And then again, the tradition is he went on and practiced austerities, again very wholeheartedly, but again that didn't seem to really actually answer his question. So eventually he gave up that and just followed his own intuition and devoted himself to mindfulness and meditation. And the tradition is he eventually broke through. He gained this state of awakening or enlightenment whilst meditating under a Bodhi tree by the river Naranjana. And after this point, he was known as the Buddha, or he was also known as the Tathagata, or various other names. And apparently he lived for a very long time after he gained enlightenment. Maybe it might have been 45 years. And he was very dedicated to sharing his understanding to whoever he met. So he must have met thousands of people. And his teaching became known as the Dharma, and those who became dedicated to that practice were members of the spiritual community, the Sangha. So although people who would have met the Buddha and would have talked to him or listened to him would have been said to have been hearing the Dharma, but something else is already happening. They're also meeting the Buddha. And often there are descriptions in the suttas of these encounters, these conversations. And many people are very inspired by his teaching. And there are many accounts of people gaining insight or even gaining enlightenment through listening to the Buddha, or through being with the Buddha. In fact, it's been said that in the Pali Suttas there seem to be more accounts of people gaining awakening through having a discourse with the Buddha than there are accounts of people gaining awakening through meditation. So it's say something about the huge impact that meeting the Buddha had for many people. And when we read these accounts of these meetings in the suttas, I think maybe often we might be very, very inspired or perhaps impressed, but for most of us we don't quite have that same traumatic effect. Most of us don't seem to gain awakening through reading these suttas. So maybe partly what's inspiring people was what the Buddha was saying. Perhaps how wise or appropriate or helpful his words were. But there's also something about the presence of the Buddha himself that's having an effect. So he seems to have been an exemplar or an embodiment of the teaching. So he was wise, but he was also compassionate. And often practitioners of the Dharma who met the Buddha would recollect their encounter with him afterwards. It might make a lifelong impression on them. And so when they would remember the Buddha, they're reconnecting with that inspiration. And I suppose the Buddha's teaching is that we can all develop spiritually and we can all gain enlightenment whoever we are, and maybe whatever's happened to us in the past, that's a possibility. Although that depends on us setting up helpful conditions and really applying ourselves as fully as we can in our practice. So when people met or when they recollected the Buddha, what they're doing is partly recollecting their own potential. And eventually this practice of contemplating the Buddha became sort of codified into like a meditation practice or different meditation practices. So there's a practice known as recollecting the Buddha, which has been handed down in the suttas even to the present day. And this goes through a sort of series of reflections about the qualities of the Buddha, and some of those reflections are in a verse in the Tiratnavandana that we sometimes chant here. And there are quite a lot of other accounts of contemplations of the Buddha. Contemporaries, it seems many of them not only thought about the Buddha and his qualities, but also visualized him, maybe just using their imagination in quite a spontaneous way, maybe their memories, or maybe just using their imagination. And I suppose through imagining the Buddha, visualizing him, some of that brings back that sense of the relational quality, the emotional connection. And maybe also with feeling those feelings of devotion that they might have felt when they met the Buddha. So that through that kind of imaginative recollection, there is that sense of remaining in the presence of the Buddha, being in the Buddha's presence again. So these recollections and visualizations perhaps started quite spontaneously during the Buddha's own lifetime. And then later they may, they seem to become codified as particular set practices. So the tradition is that the Buddha eventually died when he was about 80 years old. But people carried on recollecting the Buddha after he'd passed away, after he'd entered Parinirvana. So these traditions have carried on all the way down to today. And we can still speak in the present tense of meeting the Buddha, in the sense of something that we can encounter in our own practice. So we're not meeting the Buddha as a historical person that lived 2,500 years ago, but just meeting the Buddha as a like an archetype, as a principle that maybe is outside time and space. So Dharma practitioners have visualized the Buddha in various ways in order to keep this sense of being in the presence of the Buddha. So that's partly for, you know, devotional purposes, but maybe also for connecting to many different qualities that the Buddha had. And at some point in time, the Buddha started to appear in people's meditation practice in different ways. And eventually this evolved into almost like different Buddha figures appearing in people's meditation practice. And historically it seems that the earliest of these more archetypal Buddhas to appear were a figure called Akshobhya, who was a blue Buddha, and Amitabha, the red Buddha. So Akshobhya is particularly associated with wisdom, and Amitabha with love and compassion. So the emergence of these Buddhas perhaps connects to practitioners focusing on particular facets of the experience of enlightenment, which is multifaceted. And later on in the history of Buddhism, other Buddha figures appeared in people's meditation practice. So one of these was a figure known as Ratnasambhava, who is a yellow Buddha. And he's associated with generosity and beauty. And Amoghasiddhi, who's a green Buddha, who's associated with sort of spontaneous, compassionate activity. And Virochana, who is it's like a luminous white figure. And he's sort of seen in many traditions as almost like a central figure, but almost like integrates all these different facets of enlightenment. So there are many other Buddhas who've appeared in history, but this set of five Buddhas seems to have become particularly important in Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism in particular. And these five Buddhas came eventually to be seen arranged in a kind of like a mandala pattern. And fortunately we have that here. We've got these two images in the shrine of mandalas, with the white figure at the centre and four other Buddhas in the four directions. So Akshobhya, he's usually imagined being in the eastern direction. Ratnasambhava is often in the southerly direction. Amitabha is in the west. Amoghasiddhi is in the north. So Virochana is in the heart of the mandala. So each of these Buddhas has developed an enormous richness of symbolism and associations. And I can only really touch on a few of those this evening, but we've got quite a few months when we can start to go into each figure in more detail. So I mentioned before how when people met the historical Buddha, they would often remember their own encounter, what he said and how he was, and inevitably different people would remember different qualities of the Buddha. So maybe this might help us to understand why there are different Buddhas, as each facets are different, each sort of highlights a different facet of enlightenment. And it's been said that whichever Buddha figure we meditate on, if we practice that visualization sufficiently clear-heartedly, eventually we come to the same enlightened state. And one traditional metaphor for this is that the different Buddha figures are like different sort of wonderfully crafted stained glass windows, and each is reflecting the sunlight, the sunlight of you know, ultimate reality, ultimate kind of wisdom. There were a lot of further developments in this imagery of the mandala of the five Buddhas when the fully developed Vajrayana tradition emerged. So one example is that female Buddha figures emerged corresponding to each of the five sort of inverted commas male Buddhas. So sometimes they are depicted in sexual union with the male Buddhas, and this is like a sort of symbolising the inseparability of different qualities of Buddha. Often the male Buddha figures were meant to be symbolising the compassionate quality, and the female qualities, the wisdom quality. So one figure is actually Green Tara. She's the sort of Buddha who kind of corresponds with Moga City, the Green Buddha. And so she's an example of a female Buddha who's actually much more well known than the corresponding male figure. But apart from that, so historically the female Buddha figures haven't had so much attention as the meditation deities compared to the male Buddha figures. And I mean, it's possible that could change in time. Maybe with the modern Western world, maybe different Buddha figures will become more prominent. And I suppose whichever figure we home in on, the more we connect to it, the more it can become something that embodies all the different qualities of awakening. So I'm going to introduce each of the five Buddhas briefly to try to evoke something of their qualities. And I'm mainly going to focus tonight on describing their form and just a few associations with their form. Maybe make one or two connections to how they might relate to the historical Buddha. And then also I'm just going to try and say one or two things about a particular wisdom that each Buddha is supposed to sort of embody, and that we can gain access to through contemplating. And after the break will be a space for us to perhaps kind of get into small groups or two or three, just to talk about maybe our personal response. Is there any figure out of these Buddhas that we find some kind of intuitive resonance with? So first of all, Akshobhya. So Akshobhya is the blue Buddha. He's a sort of meant to be like a deep blue colour. And if we think about the five Buddhas as forming a mandala, often Akshobhya is the figure with whom we enter into the mandala. So often that's the eastern quarter. And he's associated with in all these figures, they're sort of seen as emerging out of blue sky in sort of visualization practice. But with Akshobhya, he's associated particularly with dawn, with the start of a new day. So we can imagine him emerging out of this vast dawn sky. And as with all of these Buddha figures, he's sitting on a beautiful fragrant lotus, a blue lotus. And each of these Buddhas are associated with a particular animal. And so Akshobhya has a connection with elephants. So traditionally he's depicted, the blue lotus he's on is supported by these elephants. And although he's this deep blue colour, he's holding a gleaming golden vajra in his hand. So the vajra there by the blue candle. And so the vajra is a sort of a representation of a diamond thunderbolt. And that was a sort of very meaningful symbol even before Buddhism. And in the Indian cosmology, Indra, the king of the gods, was supposed to hold a vajra. So Akshobhya has this symbol that conveys this power and its sense of sovereignty. And it's sort of become a very rich symbol, but in some ways it's a symbol of reality. And Akshobhya is associated particularly with wisdom of all the five Buddhas. He's associated with wisdom. And his other hand, his right hand, he's touching the earth. He's got his hand down in the earth-touching mudra. And as we probably all know, this has got the resonance to the historical Buddha's gesture when he was at the point of, on the verge of awakening, and he was challenged, what right have you to sit here on the verge of awakening? And he made this gesture of touching the earth, calling the earth goddess to witness, and she was able to emerge and say, yes, he's been practicing for all these eons, so he's ready. So there's that sense of groundedness and confidence. Akshobhya's name stands for, the translation of that is the imperturbable. So there's this quality of strength and imperturbability. I mentioned that each of the Buddha figures is associated with a quality of wisdom, and he's associated, his wisdom's called the mirror-like wisdom. And so there's something about being able to reflect, see, reflecting back things exactly as they are without being distorted. And another quality of the mirror is it doesn't hold on to what's there, what's in the mirror. It kind of just, things come and then they, and then when they're not there, then they're in the mirror. So the mirror is a sort of a not holding on. There's no attachment. So there's this sense of serenity and being very present to what's here now. So his mantra is Om Vajra Akshobhya Om. And as we move around the mandala, traditionally we come to the southern quarter next, and there we meet the yellow Buddha, Ratnasambhava. And he's described as radiating this golden light. So he's very much associated with richness, riches. And his name literally means jewel-born, although it could also be translated as jewel-producing one. And he also has an animal associated with him, so his golden-yellow lotus throne is supported by some horses. He also has his hands in a particular distinctive way. In his right hand, he's holding a jewel, and it's said to be the the wish fulfilling tool. And this was quite a this was something like a sort of a mythic jewel again in Indian cosmology. If you possess the wish fulfilling jewel, and you get whatever you desire. And maybe that kind of leads to the question of, well, what do we desire? And what really brings us happiness? So is it money and wealth and prestige or whatever? But of course these are all the things that the Buddha gave up. These are all the things he went forth from. So there's something about a deeper source of spiritual richness. And this wish-fulfilling jewel, eventually it seems to become a bit transformed into the Bodhicitta jewel in Mahayana Buddhism, this symbol of awakening that's undertaken for certain compassionate motivation. And his other hand is in the mudra. An open, it's again facing down, but it's open-handed, open out to the world. So it's a mudra of generosity. So he's, Ratnasambhava is often seen as the Buddha of generosity. So he has this riches, but he's sharing it. And each Buddha has a sort of a poison that they've transformed, and he's supposed to transform the poison of pride, and he's supposed to transform that into the wisdom of sameness. And it's connected to a sort of sense of seeing all beings or everything in the universe as being ultimately the same in certain ways. And so maybe one way in which all things are the same is that according to Buddhist teachings, everything is ultimately empty of owning. Everything's sort of insubstantial when we pay close enough attention to it. So there's a sense of, it's like a deep insight into reality. He's associated with his corresponding female Buddha. Her name is Mamaki, which means mind maker. And so there's something around a sense of seeing phenomena as not only empty, but also identifying with all things. We sometimes say we care for all things or all beings as if they were ourselves. So Ratnasambhava seems to have this understanding of emptiness, but also this quality of compassion. In the Western quarter, there is this figure, Amitabha, the Red Buddha. And he's a deep ruby red, and his name means infinite light. So he's radiating this warm red glow. And he's associated with the setting sun, that kind of very approachable, beautiful time for looking at the sun. He seems to have more devotees than almost all the other Buddha figures, and maybe he's connected to the qualities of love and compassion. There's something very appealing about that. So his red lotus throne is supported by peacocks. And there's a myth that peacocks can swallow poisonous snakes without being harmed by them. And actually, the myth is that their plumage actually becomes more beautiful through devouring these snakes. So there's again something about transformation. Amitabha's depicted in a sort of meditation posture. He's hands are resting one on the other, just poised in a sort of dhyana, in a sort of very absorbed state. So again, maybe that brings back the image of the Buddha at the time of awakening, or maybe when he was sitting, meditating in a state of bliss for quite a few weeks after gaining awakening. So there's something quite calming and centered about that. And Amitabha is supposed to be associated with the transformation of neurotic craving. And his figure seems to point to going beyond that to a deeper state of calm. He's associated with a particular wisdom called the discriminating wisdom, which is seems to complement the wisdom of sameness. It's being able to appreciate the unique qualities of all different phenomena. So that's a very sort of appreciative wisdom. So maybe for some of us we might have that kind of very aware sensitivity to someone we're very sort of infatuated with or whatever, but maybe a bit not really quite open to anyone else. So Amitabha seems to have gone beyond this state and found this quality of love that's not caught up with attachment. Yeah, so, and there's this deeper contentment and deeper understanding that he conveys. So the green Buddha is the next figure we meet, Amoghasiddhi, and he's the Buddha associated with the north. He's quite a mysterious figure. Yes, he's sort of dark green and in these wrapped around these scarlet robes. And the other figures are usually depicted in the blue sky. Amoghasiddhi traditionally is seen as being in the midnight sky. But the radiance from Amoghasiddhi is said to illuminate the sky, so everything is seen clearly and brightly. And he holds a crossed vajra in one of his hands, which we have over there by the green candle. So there's something about the union of opposites, and maybe something about complete integration. I don't know, maybe you might have your own connections as you look at the double vajra. Yeah, in the sort of ancient Indian cosmology, the whole universe was said to rest on an enormous double vajra, as if that's really what's supporting the universe. And some Buddhists have suggested maybe it's a symbol of complete psychic integration. So all the different parts of ourselves are kind of integrated. So enough of the difference between Amoghasiddhi and the other Buddhas is that most of them are sort of depicted on resting on a lotus flower on the ground. Amoghasiddhi is often depicted in the sky. His green lotus is kind of moving across the midnight sky and being borne by some mysterious creatures called Shangshangs. And they are sort of half bird, half human. And they are sort of clashing symbols as they move. Again, maybe something about bringing together something. So Amoghasiddhi is associated with with action, and his wisdom is described as the all-accomplishing wisdom. But it's said to be a very subtle kind of activity. It's not kind of rushing about, and a Buddha's actions are said not to be driven by the kind of urges or compulsions that maybe most of us are usually driven by, but something that kind of goes beyond what we normally think of as volition. So he's associated with this kind of spontaneous, compassionate action. And one other striking thing about Omega City is that his left hand is in, what's his left hand, is in this mudra of fearlessness, which is kind of up near the heart and pointing outwards. And it's worth spending some time looking at an image of Omega City in this gesture and just having a sense of what that communicates. But it's the mood of fearlessness, that's my own sense, and that seems to fit somehow what's been communicated there. So maybe for many of us, well, we're probably frightened of different things, but maybe there is a sense of having something to protect about our own sort of ego. Maybe that's part of what underlies fear in many situations. So the awakened mind has gone beyond that sense of me in here and the world out there, that sense of self, other. So maybe I think there's a lot of stories of the Buddha being fearless himself. I think there's one story of some people trying to threaten to kill the Buddha, and the Buddha apparently came out of his hut in the middle of the night, and some of his monks were standing guarding him with sticks, and he just said, "No, go away, the Buddha doesn't need any protection." Yeah. Lots of stories of him being fearlessly compassionate, like him going to this mass murderer, Angulimala, who everyone said, "Keep away from him, he's dangerous," but somehow he was able to meet Angulimala, and actually Angulimala became converted to the Dharma through his meeting. So the final Buddha in the centre, his name is Virochana, which means illuminator. And he's said to be a gleaming white colour, like the colour of sunshine on freshly fallen snow. So it's very radiant, white, brilliant colour. And he's on a white throne, and this throne is supported by lions. And again, the lions were sort of seen as like the kings of the animal kingdom. And I think the Buddha was often described as being like a lion, and his teaching like the lion's roar of the Dharma. There's also a lot of sun symbolism connected to Virochana, so the name illuminator that seems to perhaps evokes the sun. And so Virochana, I mean, I think there were different traditions of different kinds of mandalas, but I think this comes from the Nyingmapa tradition, which we seem to particularly focus on in Sri Ratna. So Virochana is usually in the centre of this mandala. But maybe there is something about kind of coming into the centre and what that means. He's although he's white, he's depicted as holding a golden wheel, which is a Dharma chakra wheel. And again, that was a that seems to have been connected to an ancient Indian symbol of sovereignty. I think the kings were described as having their a chakravartin wheel as what they, as part of their what they their sort of things that they were had as sort of ritual implements, and it was a sort of a symbol of kingship and yes sovereignty. And but in the Buddhist tradition, that became a sort of symbol, a very significant symbol for the Dharma. And so the Dharma chakra wheel is an important symbol. It's often usually got eight spokes around the wheel, and that's supposed to connect up to the eightfold path. And so often that connects us up to the first teaching of the Buddha. The Dharma started. So perhaps the Eightfold Path, again, that suggests something around total transformation. So usually, Vimochana's wisdom, it's usually not translated into English. It's described as the Dharma Dhatu wisdom. And I think essentially it is a sort of integration of all the different kinds of wisdom that the different Buddha figures have. But it's sometimes described as like a sort of like a panoramic kind of awareness. And maybe we can think about the sun in the middle of the sky and just kind of radiating out that sense of complete awareness, but also, yeah, just kind of radiating out to all beings. Maybe one final association with this is of almost like kind of getting to that point of awakening, and then this symbol which seems to communicate something around sharing that experience, sharing the experience of awakening, which seems to be what the Buddha's decided to do after he gained his own insight. So there's quite a lot in the Dharma chakra itself, and maybe one can think about that as being a bit like the gateway into another mandala within the mandala.